Public transit is divisive. It's a messy subject worldwide where politics, sociology, and economics all clash. But nowhere does it draw more controversy and deliver worse results than in the United States. This is the richest nation on Earth, yet driving is far more common than public transport, and ridership here is low relative to any other developed country. That's not an accident. In the decades after World War II, the US deliberately reshaped itself into a car-centric nation. Dense, transit-dependent urban centers gave way to sprawling suburbs of single-family homes on quarter-acre lots. The American dream sold families on a big house, a yard, the latest appliances, and your own car in the driveway. It was a cultural identity that had long existed, but after the war was reshaped into an ideological construct and marketing tool. The US government used the American dream to reintegrate veterans, fuel consumerism, motivate the population, and showcase capitalism over Soviet-style communism. Home and car ownership were elevated not just as domestic status symbols, but promoted as global proof that only American capitalism could deliver mass prosperity and equal opportunity. While war-torn Europe nationalized key services like healthcare, education, and transit, America, in the same period, subsidized suburban mortgages, rewarded mass-production homes, and funded the surrounding infrastructure. With a steady stream of buyers, private developers made fortunes building wherever land was cheap. Walkability and transit didn't matter. Meanwhile, car makers, oil companies, and tire manufacturers lobbied for highways and actively dismantled streetcars to ensure that cars would become the primary mode of transport for future generations of Americans. While Europe and Asia invested in public transit and compact urban development, the US funneled hundreds of billions of dollars into interstate highways, enabling suburban homeowners to commute to urban jobs by car. All of these measures not only fueled sprawl, but also diverted investment away from urban housing and public transit. Today, the United States stands alone as the only country where suburban, car-dependent single-family housing is the norm. Yet cities like New York City, Chicago, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, and Boston all boast the highest public transit ridership in the country, despite this generational prioritization of cars. While public transit has been underinvested through history, it's not accurate to say that there's been no investment. U.S. public transit agencies serve fewer riders than their international counterparts, yet cost more money than anywhere else, with annual operating budgets that exceed billions of dollars. But whether it's rampant crime and poor hygiene, or just basic on-time performance and fare collection, public transit in America consistently ranks amongst the worst in the developed world in nearly every metric. Every year, they set a global record for how much money they lose. Adjust for currency, normalize into percentages, and the answer is the same. No one offers less, spends as much money, and still somehow loses more on public transit than America. This isn't a post-COVID issue or a one-year anomaly. These are the average annual operating margins for each agency over the past 6 to 15 years. Transit advocates regularly trumpet that public transit is an essential service, not a business, and that measuring profit is useless. They point to valid double standards, like how U.S. roads themselves to this day are not fully funded by drivers, and their losses are covered by taxpayers. But guess what? Even the transit systems in Europe and Asia that Americans idolize, the Taipei subway, the Tokyo subway, the Madrid metro, or the Paris RER, all chase profit. These agencies not only boast the best on-time rates and highest ridership in the world, but also operate like for-profit businesses. They publish annual reports, share progress, outline clear goals, track revenue, and explain their financial performance with the same diligence as a publicly traded corporation. The hard truth that Reddit idealists struggle to face is that profit is the best measure of effectiveness and efficiency. When money is the primary input and constraint, no metric matters more than the bottom line. Profit is a forcing function and feedback mechanism. It tells you when something's broken and pushes you to either work smarter or harder. Even NGOs and charities evaluate themselves on how much money they bring in, their impact relative to their spend, and how much money is left to keep going. And the world's leading transit systems optimize for profit just as much as performance. It's not like Europe and Asia have perfected public transit. Even though they've invested more, the reality is that every agency is constantly overcoming the same obstacles of labor shortages, worker strikes, service complaints, bureaucracy, aging infrastructure, and funding challenges. Money is scarce everywhere. It's not like the Tokyo, Paris, and Berlin metros get blank checks. Most agencies are still able to rake in consistent operating profits, showing that it is possible to operate public transit without losing money. For those that are not profitable, they actively control their losses, and they find ways to do more with less. The Taipei Metro and Seoul Metro, for instance, have experienced declining ridership and profits since COVID. In response, they've cut service, frozen hiring, and suspended raises. The profitable Berlin BVG, Hong Kong MTR, Tokyo Metro, and Taiwan High-Speed Rail invest their surplus by upgrading systems, hiring more staff, and giving bonuses to their existing workers. In short, these agencies all operate within the boundaries of profit and loss, deficit and surplus, revenue and expenses accordingly, no different from how a regular for-profit business behaves in the private sector. Contrast that with the US, where transit agencies make no attempt to be independent. They burn through billions, ask for more, burn through that, and still cry about being underfunded, even as service and rider experience decline. They serve fewer riders and smaller populations, but still employ the same, if not more, workers than the leading Asian and European systems. Instead of managing finances, they double down, hiring more people and raising wages year after year, further deepening their losses. Unless workers in Japan, Taiwan, Italy, or even France are naturally more productive than Americans, there is no justification for higher costs and worse results. Underinvestment can explain delays, but it can't explain this level of chronic mismanagement and inefficiency. Only in America, where capitalism supposedly rewards efficiency and value, has public transit become this dysfunctional machine that serves only to enrich unions and workers. Fraud and corruption get a slap on the wrist. A manager had sex with a subordinate multiple times on the clock, and both weren't fired. A station agent pocketed fares for over a decade and retired with a full pension. A customer service rep claimed to work 100-hour work weeks to steal $250,000. A foreman made nearly $500,000 while being at home during shifts he claimed to be working, yet faced no punishment. A janitor took home $270,000, but was found napping in the storage area as a ploy to milk overtime, and 10 years later, he's still there. This isn't a case of a few bad apples. These incidents span different agencies and cities. It's not mismanagement or incompetence. It's corruption and embezzlement, and it's systemic in American public transit. Ironically, this doesn't happen in the EU or Asia. Not even the French, with their 35-hour work weeks, aggressive worker protections, and militant unions, engage in this kind of behavior. Corruption has been institutionalized at nearly every major transit agency in the US across decades. This is the real reason why politicians prefer to repave intersections or add lanes to busy highways, even though they know it won't solve congestion. Roadwork has predictable costs, a clear scope of work, concrete turnaround, and nets visible, even if temporary, results. In contrast, money given to public transit vanishes into a black hole, only to be met with complaints that it still wasn't enough. What many Americans fail to understand is public transit requires good governance. With the wrong leaders, broken incentives, complacency, and systemic corruption, more money just leads to more waste. Yet the prevailing attitude nationwide is apathy. You get the sheltered Americans who claim that public transit is totally acceptable. They've personally never had a bad experience their whole lives. Then there are the activists who dismiss economic realities and live in fantasy, shouting that transit should be free and that billion-dollar losses don't matter. Next are the defeatists who assert that inefficient and ineffective transit is just a natural part of city life. Then there are the apologists who invent all sorts of geographical or technical reasons as to why public transit is uniquely difficult in America, as if the engineers in Europe and Asia built their systems on flat land and perfect weather. And finally, there's the older generations who are so vested in suburban life and home appreciation that they don't think urban public transit matters at all. In this episode, we dive into transit systems around the world to expose the uniquely rotten economics of American public transit, where unions drain public funds, stifle innovation, and cut backroom deals with politicians to protect their own interests. What does the future hold in business? Ask 9 experts and you'll get 10 answers. Tune into any news program and you'll get pundits talking about equities, interest rates, and inflation. One week they'll talk about how it's going up and then say it's going down in the next. Could someone please invent a crystal ball? Until then, over 42,000 businesses have future-proofed their business with NetSuite by Oracle, the number one AI cloud ERP, bringing accounting, finance, inventory, and HR into one fluid platform. With one unified business management suite, there's one source of truth, giving you the visibility and control you need to make quick decisions. With real-time insights and forecasting, you're peering into the future with actionable data. When you're closing the books in days, not weeks, you're spending less time looking backwards and more time on what's next. Modern MBA is small at the moment, but as soon as we scale, we will need and use NetSuite. Today, we're stitching things manually, and it's gotten harder to assess our business health. We need to track production costs, to run payroll compliant with multiple states, and to evaluate profit and loss by team and project. As a corporation, we pay tax throughout the year, and it's a nightmare jumping from system to system just to get one answer. These are capabilities that only NetSuite provides, and it's a platform we intend to take every advantage of. Whether your company is earning millions or even hundreds of millions, NetSuite helps you respond to immediate challenges and seize your biggest opportunities. Speaking of opportunity, download the CFO's Guide to AI and Machine Learning at netsuite.com/modernmba. The guide is free to you at netsuite.com/modernmba. netsuite.com/modernmba. As we covered earlier, public transit in the U.S. is an anomaly because of how the country was shaped after World War II. Beyond the American dream and suburban housing boom, it was the auto industry who pushed for roads over public transit. Manufacturers like Ford and General Motors, alongside their partners like Standard Oil and Firestone Tires, all saw this historic opportunity to turn generations of Americans into lifetime customers. They didn't just lobby for the 1956 Interstate Highway Act. They also tore out the pre-existing, widely used streetcar networks across cities, forcing millions to become car owners with no other remaining alternatives for commuting. Decades later, the U.S. maintains this political commitment to free market principles and individual liberty, with most goods and services provided and shaped by the private sector rather than the government. We can see this at a macro level as America overall, across federal and state, consistently spends substantially less of its GDP on its citizens when compared to other developed countries. But it's not necessarily about the overall percentage, but what it gets allocated towards. After all the mandatory programs like Social Security and Medicare, the single greatest category that gets the most funding is national defense. Throughout history, the U.S. military-industrial complex has been the most well-funded category and highest national priority, garnering hundreds of billions of dollars every year. America invests more dollars into warfare than everything else that builds a country, like education, agriculture, energy, and transportation. This isn't a new development. It's been like this for generations under both Democrat and Republican rule. After defense, transportation gets a fraction of what's left. Even during the suburban American dream and highway construction of the 1960s and 70s, transportation never made up more than 8% of federal spending. But this isn't unusual. France, Germany, and Spain invest even less of their GDP into transportation infrastructure. The difference is that for the U.S., highways, unsurprisingly, have received the overwhelming majority of investment ahead of public transit and airports. From the 40s to 70s, every penny went directly to highways. As the interstate highway system neared completion in the 1980s, federal funding naturally declined from roughly 80% of transportation to about 70% in later decades. While public transit was clearly deprioritized, it wasn't abandoned. Since the early 2000s, federal investment in public transit has steadily increased from just a few percentage points to nearly 30% today. Even under both Trump administrations, funding has remained largely intact. Even though highways still get the lion's share, there's clearly been a change in attitude towards public transit over the decades. It's objectively not as fast or as big as it should be, but we're still talking about tens of billions of dollars every year distributed directly into the pockets of transit agencies across the nation. For the $226 billion invested in the past decade, money is hardly a valid excuse for the state of American public transit today. Of the billions that each agency has received directly from this pool, other developed countries have spent the same amount to build a brand new metro system or high-speed rail. Anyone who's run any business knows that it's not about how much you spend, it's how you spend it. European and Asian countries do have that advantage of speed and efficiency in that they can move faster with centralized planning, design, and construction. Public transit overseas is a national priority, and their governments can cut through all the red tape overnight, whereas American agencies must navigate state and local politics themselves just to get projects on paper. But while this explains why it's so slow to break ground, it still doesn't explain where exactly those billions of dollars have disappeared to. The go-to excuse across the nation is that all the money gets eaten up by deferred maintenance. Every agency insists that keeping these 70 to 100-year-old systems running after decades of neglect is simply that expensive. Maintenance, they say, drains the budget and leaves nothing for upgrades, so any modernization requires billions in additional capital funding. But even if all these agencies directed their funds to capital upgrades or new projects, they'd still be bleeding money and spiraling into ever greater deficits. The real cost drivers are the absurdly inflated labor costs around the country that come from union lock-in, chronic overtime abuse, artificial overstaffing, inflated salaries, bloated pensions, and contractual work rules that serve no purpose except to extract more pay while on the clock. Don't take our word for it. Morrison & Foerster, one of the most prestigious American law firms, arrived at the same conclusions in writing. The New York MTA had hired them in mid-2019 to audit its perpetual runaway labor costs. The unions ended up stonewalling the lawyers during their two-month investigation, and the report was quickly swept aside once COVID took over headlines. Still, labor is the largest operating cost for every public transit system in the world, regardless of whether their operators are privatized, state-owned, or municipally run. It's singularly more expensive than fuel, parts, maintenance, and rent. Even in Asia, where the large populations and collectivist culture have kept salaries low for generations, labor remains the single highest cost for the leading transit systems in Hong Kong, South Korea, Taiwan, and Singapore. Only a handful of agencies have labor costs well below 50% of their operating budget. Among them are Boston's MBTA, London's TfL, Tokyo Metro, and Japan's privatized JR rail companies. These are outliers who have achieved their dramatically lower labor costs through outsourcing or culture, as we'll analyze later. But for the most part, the majority of the world's transit systems are run in-house. Public transit is inherently labor-intensive, even more so than manufacturing. They're open systems, unlike factories, and they deal with so many different variables that the best solution is often still manual. Buses and trains have to be driven, staff must be at stations and on standby at all hours to address issues, and facilities can only be manually inspected, cleaned, and maintained. Even if we set aside the issues surrounding unions and funding, automation will always be tricky to implement, given the sheer number of edge cases and high stakes of safely moving thousands of humans around in a small fleet of vehicles. The other reason for universal high labor cost is that public transit work is hard and unattractive. Working as a bus driver, station attendant, subway cleaner, or rail mechanic is not easy. These are not jobs that most people would leap to do, and their skills are not easily transferable to other sectors. Unless you relocate, there's only ever going to be one, maybe two systems that you could ever work at within a single city. When we look at average wages, we can see that every transit operator in the world pays a premium to attract and retain talent. If we looked at absolute amounts by currency, the US would lead every time by the strength of the dollar alone. The only fair comparison is to normalize for currency and cost of living by measuring compensation as a percentage above the local average. In Asia, transit workers make on average 52% more compared to a full-time worker in the same city. This is total compensation, which includes benefits and pensions, and are real dollar costs for every agency, even if it's not captured in an immediate paycheck. And in Europe, the premium for transit workers across the continent is 38%. Higher pay is just the cost of business in public transit. But the US surpasses both continents with the highest paid transit workers in the world, averaging total compensation that's 114% higher than full-time salaried workers in the same cities. New Jersey and New York pay the best, with compensation premiums well above the national average. The SF Muni, which ranks 7th in the country with ridership below Chicago and Washington, D.C., pays their workers as much as a mid-level software engineer. There's another way to visualize just how much better paid American transit workers are compared to their overseas counterparts, wage multiple. This metric shows how many times a transit worker's pay exceeds the local median income. When we rank the 23 agencies in our dataset by wage multiple, American agencies dominate. 8 out of the top 10 are in the US, with workers that earn 2 to 3 times the local median income. Now, a better paid workforce can be justifiable if they're more productive, effective, and able to render higher quality or larger scale services. But if we re-rank all 23 agencies in our dataset by ridership, we find there's virtually no relationship between how well workers get paid to how many riders they're able to service. If anything, it's the inverse. The agencies that move the most people consistently operate with lower wage multiples, while US agencies serve the fewest riders yet pay the highest relative to local incomes. Next, we can measure the labor productivity of each agency by the number of riders that each employee serves. But when we divide the number of writers by the size of the workforce, we find that all of the US agencies aren't just overpaid, they're overstaffed. They serve the fewest number of writers per employee while paying the highest wage multiples in the world. Despite their labor advantages, the Asian agencies are ironically the most lean as they serve the most number of passengers for the fewest number of employees. There's nothing wrong with paying above market wages when it's the global standard, but if you're paying the highest wages, double Europe and four times that of Asia, while losing millions or billions annually, something has to change. To reduce labor costs, you can lay off staff or lower salaries. If you can't do those things, then at the bare minimum, you can contain the cost by freezing hiring and raises.
This isn't a sociological debate or some twisted Wall Street formula. It's just basic math.
Instead, American transit agencies around the country all make the worst possible choice. They increase their labor costs on every front, expanding headcount by 2-5% and issuing 2-7% raises year after year for over a decade. As a result, labor costs have spiraled so far that no amount of federal funding, ridership growth, or fare increase could ever keep up. In contrast, every profitable European or Asian transit agency reinvests its surplus into either headcount or wages, never both. Labor costs stay contained because they commit to holding one constant while raising the other. It's ironic that socialist Europeans and collectivist Asians are better capitalists than the Americans themselves when it comes to public transit. When you're deep in the red, paying top dollar salaries and still handing out raises and/or adding headcount every year, that's beyond bad business. Asia as a region is often ridiculed as simply riding the coattails of globalization, but when it comes to public transit, it's leading, not copying. Whether it's South Korea, Taiwan, China, or Japan, these countries all boast world-class systems with incredible networks, reliability, punctuality, speed, cleanliness, safety, and comfort that are simply unimaginable in the West. These countries all have weaker economies, currencies, buying power, and poorer citizens. They don't have the consumerism and foreign investment that the United States uniquely enjoys, where they can just print cash or rack up debt to fund new projects. With less cash at hand and a higher margin of error, the leading transit systems in Asia defy logic in both operations and business performance. The Shanghai and Beijing subways enjoy the highest ridership in the world, but without public financials, our next best option is the Tokyo Metro. It's one of the world's most consistently profitable agencies, with an average annual operating margin of 15% in the past 8 years, even during COVID. They're a for-profit, partially privatized transit operator that receives no operating subsidies from the Japanese government. Self-sufficiency is not a goal, it's a requirement. If they need funds for day-to-day operations, they must generate that revenue and profit themselves. Ultimately, sustainable public transit isn't rocket science. You control labor costs on one end and maximize revenue on the other. Tokyo Metro's profits come from their exceptionally low labor costs, which represent less than a quarter of their annual operating expenses. This means that for every $1,000 that the agency spends, only $240 goes to workers, and the remainder is split between utilities, energy, equipment, and parts. They've barely grown since 2017, with the average annual workforce growth at just 0.2% per year. And while workers still make 25% more than the median full-time employee in Tokyo, they've received virtually no raises for the past 8 years. Median worker compensation has increased just 0.6% per year during that period. As a result, transit workers' real wages have effectively declined and consistently lagged behind inflation and cost of living. This is a product of culture and economy as much as efficiency. The Japanese live to work rather than work to live, as the society upholds job dedication above personal health. Japan's economic stagnation since the 1990s is well documented. Wages have stagnated not just for transit workers, but across the private and public sector as well. Meanwhile, the nail that sticks out gets hammered down. The local emphasis on conformity, social harmony, and civic duty discourages dissent, no matter how disgruntled workers may feel. Tokyo Metro workers are unionized, but these cultural norms still prevail. Under Japan's enterprise unionism, the focus is on cooperation over confrontation. Strikes are symbolic, disputes are handled privately, and negotiations are collaborative. Since the Japanese value employment over wages, they have a vested interest in making sure the company, or in this case, the transit operator, can survive long term. As a result, the Tokyo Metro unions have historically focused their efforts on preventing layoffs rather than issuing aggressive wage demands. At the same time, the Tokyo Metro is exceptional at generating and collecting revenue. Japan's high-trust, law-abiding culture, combined with a closed fare system, results in one of the lowest fare evasion rates in the world. This also helps keep labor down, safety up, and efficiency high, as they don't need ticket inspectors like most systems depend on in the West. Tokyo Metro makes 90% of its money from tickets, and the remaining 10% in advertising and real estate. They follow the rail plus property strategy, where stations are not just stops where people can get on and get off, but also hubs that they can shop and eat at. And since the infrastructure already exists, the agency extracts further revenue from these existing assets by renting out these valuable, high-foot traffic spots. While Tokyo Metro is profitable and gets no operating subsidies, they still need help to afford the big projects like line modernization, network expansion, station remodeling, and fleet upgrades. Despite their strong track record and global reputation, Tokyo Metro gets no slack. They must demonstrate financial viability, cost effectiveness, and return on investment on every proposed capital project to secure any external funding. The agency isn't just required to quantify the projected benefits and justify their needs. It must also prove that it can cover the long-term maintenance and operating costs without subsidies. But even after approval, the national government only funds at most one-third of construction costs. Tokyo Metro, as an agency, must come up with the remaining two-thirds on their own, whether that's through profits, bonds, or bank loans. As the majority backer, this is financial accountability by design. If a project overruns or underperforms, that's money the agency won't ever get back and consequences that they must live with. These same business principles govern Japan's other transit agencies, which operate at an even greater scale. There's JR West and JR East, who handle not only urban rail like Tokyo Metro, but also longer distance intercity rail, interregional bullet trains, and buses. Both have been profitable for the past 10 years. Like Tokyo Metro, they get zero operating subsidies and are required to be financially sustainable. As fully privatized for-profit corporations, JR West and JR East have taken the rail plus property business model to the highest level. They build, manage, and rent office buildings, shopping malls, apartments, and even hotels around their stations on top of the usual in-station retail. They even operate their own travel agencies and contactless smart card systems to drive further dollars from banking and tourism. Growing passenger flow through stations is ultimately the biggest driver of land appreciation and rental income. As a result, public transit has become more like a loss leader that drives cash flow but little profits. If we look at just the transit business, we can see that on average, both agencies just barely break even, meaning all the profits come from the other businesses. Still, even with higher margin ventures, both agencies are still constantly adjusting to financial realities. It's a simple calculus. If riders and revenue are down, then costs must come down. JR East serves the most riders out of the three, but has seen declining ridership and fare revenue since COVID. So they've downsized by shrinking their transit workforce by an average of 5% every year. JR East isn't laying off workers. They've just opted not to backfill the people who've retired to maintain their profit margins. For the transit workers that have stayed, they're actually paid a greater premium than their Tokyo Metro peers, but their rates have remained just as stagnant. Total worker compensation has grown at just 1.2% per year for the past 8. While JR West's fare revenue has rebounded to pre-COVID levels far more quickly, it's the same variable, different inputs. The riders are back, revenue has recovered, and so costs can remain flat. As a result, JR West hasn't cut staff as aggressively as its eastern counterpart. But worker compensation hasn't grown at all over the past decade. JR East, JR West, and Tokyo Metro aren't capitalists, squeezing workers, or state-backed entities walking around with blank checks. They've all succeeded by operating rationally, within business constraints, and adjusting to the economic and cultural realities of their country. The Taipei Metro is another example of the property plus rail model in action, but under a more Americanized culture. With roughly 2 million in annual ridership, it's smaller in scale compared to the Japanese systems, but not any less sustainable. Looking at historical annual operating margin, the Taipei Metro trails the Tokyo Metro, but is on par with JR West and JR East. With a more individualistic culture, stronger economy, and better work-life balance relative to Japan, labor costs for the Taipei Metro are 58% of annual operating expenses, which is closer to the benchmark of transit agencies in the West. Taipei Metro workers are unionized, and relative to Japan, are far more outspoken given their ties to Taiwan's political parties. But the unions have focused far more on worker protection than wages, potentially because of just how significantly well-paid the transit workers are, especially for the public sector. Taipei Metro workers are paid at significantly greater premiums above the local standard, especially when compared to Japan's transit agencies. Taipei Metro has historically reinvested its minimal profits into its existing workforce. Workers have received standard cost of living increases of 2.3% for the past decade. The agency has accounted for these greater costs by controlling headcount. The workforce has grown less than 1% on average year over year over the same period. Same calculus, if riders and revenue are up, then you can spend surplus to grow either wages or headcount. While Taipei Metro has turned some stations into shopping malls and retail spaces, passenger fare still accounts for over 80% of annual revenue. Because it's municipally owned and operated, the agency has never needed to aggressively pursue commercial opportunities and rental income like privatized operators such as JR West and JR East. But ridership has declined since COVID, and the agency has been unable to shake losses with a fare-centric business. Taipei Metro receives no operating subsidies despite its ownership model. Breaking even is expected, and losses are unacceptable. Now with 4 consecutive years of operating deficits, Taiwan is urgently exploring ways to close the gap. Whether it's eliminating discounts, raising fares, or expanding on rental income, all options are now on the table. The Taipei Metro relies on the national government to fund capital projects, and like the Tokyo Metro, still undergoes scrutiny for every proposal. They must prove a self-liquidity ratio of 1 or higher, meaning that the project will generate enough income to cover its future operating costs. If a project's SLR scores below a 1, it gets rejected. Even the largest, most prestigious transit agency in Taiwan must still prove business ROI for funding. Hong Kong's MTR, a partially privatized rail and bus operator, is the world's most profitable transit agency. The MTR does not receive any operating subsidies or outside funding for capital projects. Ironically, their capitalist excellence is fueled more by their colonial upbringing and communist governance rather than the free market. Like it is in China, all the land in Hong Kong is owned by the state. You can only own the structure built on top of the land, like the building, house, apartment, or office. You lease the land from the government for decades at a time. It's a huge contrast from the US, the West, Japan, and Taiwan, where when you buy a property, you own the land and structure. In countries where private land ownership is a thing, most of the value is in the land. Buying houses in the Bay Area, Manhattan, Tokyo, or Taipei is expensive not because of how nice they are, but because of how scarce the land is in these desirable areas. This is why appreciation is much lower in arrangements where you buy the structure but not the land, like a condo or co-op. In Hong Kong, what began as a mechanism for colonial rule under the British in the 1800s has been maintained by the Chinese Communist Party as a part of present-day Hong Kong. Ownership aside, land here is infamously scarce. Hong Kong ranks as the world's most expensive city in price per square meter, ahead of even Zurich and New York City. With all the land in the hands of the state, the government holds tremendous power. They can relocate citizens and reclaim land anytime to make way for public transit. As the MTR's majority owner, the Hong Kong government grants the agency direct access to land at preferential prices that no private developer could ever obtain. Life revolves around the MTR as car ownership in Hong Kong is among the lowest in the developed world. When a new MTR station is built, it doesn't just improve access to another part of the city, it instead injects an invaluable supply of housing, retail, and commercial space that simply did not exist before. The MTR also gets rights for the adjacent lots. So they also design the surrounding shopping malls, offices, hotels, high-rises, parks, garages, and even the roads that connect everything together. They construct parts of the site themselves and sell the remaining to developers at a premium. The MTR, in effect, is more than a transit agency. It's the city's most powerful developer, landlord, and urban planner who profits directly from the land value they unlock. However, like Taipei, fares still contribute 80% of the MTR's annual revenue. The cash infusions, profit sharing, and rents from real estate only enable the MTR to fund capital projects on their own. They're not high enough to offset labor costs, which are the agency's greatest, coming in at over 50% of annual operating expense. Even with industry-leading margins and a guaranteed cash flow engine, the Hong Kong MTR exercises fiscal restraint and discipline. Land rights are not treated like a license to overspend. profits have been reinvested into the workforce, as the average MTR worker has enjoyed a median annual raise of 6% every year for the past 9 years, despite the fact that there's no officially recognized union or collective bargaining laws in Hong Kong. Meanwhile, headcount has remained virtually flat, with annual increases of less than 1% over the same period. It's the same calculus: increase hiring or wages, but never both. Singapore has two main transit agencies, SBS and SMRT, but only the former has financials. SBS Transit is a majority privatized bus and rail operator with a unique model. Their primary customer isn't the public, but the government. The state owns all the buses, depots, trains, and stations, and outsources the day-to-day to SBS under multi-year licenses. Compensation depends on performance, and payment scales to how well the company can meet established service and quality benchmarks. In practice, SBS functions less like a transit agency and more like a transit staffing company. They've been able to squeeze profit with an average annual operating margin of 3.5% since 2017, but it's come at the expense of workers. Labor is their greatest cost at 51% of their annual operating expenses. With strict contracts, razor-thin margins, no hard assets, and a purely transactional relationship with the government, SBS only survives by aggressively controlling labor. They pay the lowest premiums of any transit operator in the world. Headcount has grown on average less than 1% per year for the past 8. And what little profits existed are reinvested into the workforce, with a median annual raise of 2.7% per year for almost a decade. Singapore caps foreign staff at 35% of the transit workforce for national security reasons, so with low pay, physically demanding jobs, and limited local interest, raises are effectively SBS's only retention tool. But this is Singapore, a one-party state that rules with an iron fist, holds strict control over the media, and aggressively suppresses dissent. SBS's longevity can also be attributed to this political environment. Since the 1960s, Singapore has systematically weakened unions with laws that force all worker grievances into state arbitration, impose bureaucratic barriers that make organizing impossible, and punish anyone who deviates. In the past 40 years, there have only ever been 2 transit strikes, and the bus drivers involved were arrested and deported. Asia is home to the world's most profitable transit agencies, and we've covered only the ones with high ridership and audited public financials. There is something that each agency does that's worth learning from, and then other aspects that would be impossible to replicate in the West. The property plus rail model would never fly in America because private land ownership is integral, and no government could bypass NIMBYism. The success of both private and public transit agencies in Asia shows that profit has everything to do with business discipline rather than ownership. With above-market wages and constrained hiring across their board, their bottom lines are not based on cheap labor, but simply controlled labor cost as a whole. Despite their record performance, no agency is free to spend indiscriminately. Operating losses are heavily scrutinized, and external funding always comes with contingencies, oversight, and proof of ROI. We can see the same calculus in Europe. Transport for London is the continent's largest transit operator by measure of ridership and scope, covering all the rail networks from the underground subway to the above-ground surface rail on top of buses, major roads, and ferries. As a state-owned enterprise, TfL has been unprofitable for much of its lifetime, averaging annual operating margins of negative 35% since 2017. For decades, it survived on a £700 million annual operating subsidy. That changed in 2018 when Mayor Boris Johnson's government cut all operating subsidies, contending that after billions in rail modernization, TfL should be able to stand on its own. This made the agency the only transit operator in Europe to receive no operating subsidies from the government. Without this safety net, the agency scrambled to grow revenue and cut costs. They increased fares and congestion pricing, tacked on extra fees for non-electric vehicles, sold more advertising space, and even lifted a page from the Hong Kong MTR in partnering with private developers to turn surplus land into rentable, mixed-use areas. On the cost side, they consolidated management, cut staff, and have kept wage increases minimal. The results have been stark. Median worker compensation has fallen 1% per year for the past 9 years. It's the lowest in all of Europe. The workforce has also shrunk at almost the same pace. TfL is the only leading transit operator in Europe whose staff has decreased every year since 2017. While unpopular, the decision to throw the transit agency into the deep end has delivered progress. COVID is really the only reason TfL is unprofitable. Fare revenue, the main cash flow for any transit agency, has only recently returned to pre-pandemic levels. But non-fare revenue, so all the property development, advertising, congestion pricing, has not just doubled in 4 years, it's grown from 9% to nearly 30% of annual revenue. Operating losses have substantially shrunk year after year to record lows, and the agency is closer to self-sufficiency than ever. These are simply the fruits of combining basic business and urgency. Since 2020, the UK government has resumed its operating subsidies to keep the agency afloat, but those cash infusions are separately accounted for. Yet the issue that remains is the quality of service, reliability, and on-time performance on the Underground, Overground, and Elizabeth Line have all declined to levels worse than before COVID and before these cost-cutting measures were put in place. The buses have been bearing the brunt of it. Much of this has to do with the staffing structure. Labor accounts for just 27% of TfL's annual operating expenses, some of the lowest in the world and on par with the Japanese privatized operators. While the core subway and rail are operated in-house, the buses are contracted out to private third parties who get paid by performance, like SBS in Singapore. Naturally, job cuts and stagnant pay have not sat well with TfL's unionized workers. Over the past 4 years, they've staged increasingly larger strikes for better pay and working conditions. The agency has conceded to their demands, agreeing to raise salaries by 5 to 11% for rail workers. Ultimately, TfL's push for day-to-day financial independence is a net positive. Being forced to identify and find solutions to problems within constraints is healthy. Where can you grow revenue to offset the inevitable surge in labor costs without just hiking up fares? How do you improve the rail performance without simply committing more bodies to the problem? Without challenges like these, innovation doesn't happen. RATP is the transit agency in Paris. It's state-owned and operated and runs the bus and rail for the city and greater metro. RATP leads the continent in profitability, with an annual average operating margin of 6% in the past 12 years. This profit is derived from government subsidies rather than conventional passenger fare revenue, but it's not a blank check or handout. Instead, RATP follows a unique structure where the agency is still forced to operate as if it's an independent for-profit company that bears all the consequences in the event of a loss. Despite facilitating almost as many riders as TfL, RATP doesn't pocket fares. But if they did, it would never be enough to offset the labor costs, even before the pandemic when ridership was high. Instead, all the revenue comes from IDFM, the Regional Transit Authority, which is governed by the national government, regional council, city, and surrounding counties. These members all pool together payroll tax, contributions, and the fare revenue to fund the IDFM. The IDFM then pays RATP a predetermined lump sum every year based on the operator's own forecast, which only covers operating costs and capital projects. This annual fee is locked in for 4 years at a time, and every cycle involves tense negotiation. Naturally, RATP will always ask for more money, and IDFM will push back, asking for justification or inserting contingencies. The only way RATP can turn a profit under this arrangement is through performance bonuses. If they hit all their targets in reliability, punctuality, customer satisfaction, and cleanliness, then they can earn a full 100 million euro bonus. Miss these targets, and they lose the same amount. In a country with 35-hour workweeks and militant unions, this convoluted structure manufactures scarcity. IDFM keeps RATP just alive enough to function, forcing it to innovate, maximize resources, and prove their fiscal responsibility before they can ask for more. Because the annual rate is locked in, RATP can't overspend and rack up deficits using money they don't have and won't get. They're forced to find ways to hit their performance targets without simply throwing more bodies at the problem. Because getting funding is such a slow, exhausting bureaucratic process, RATP is incentivized to turn a profit to break away from its overbearing parent. Profits not only provide a buffer against shocks, but also give RATP the freedom to invest in its own priorities without approval. Consistent and greater profits grants RATP stronger leverage during negotiations for bigger future annual fees. Labor is RATP's greatest cost at 53% of annual operating expense. Surpluses have gone mostly to headcount growth, averaging 3% a year over the past decade. Wages, though, have barely budged, with annual increases of less than 1% for the past 12 years. And to prevent labor costs from snowballing, worker compensation has remained fairly stagnant, with a median annual raise of less than 1% per year for the past 12. This stagnation reflects a wider trend of austerity within France's public sector, where wages have been frozen for nearly a decade as the national deficit balloons. The French have blown past the fiscal rules of the European Union for decades, borrowing over 100% of their GDP every year to fund their exceptionally generous welfare programs. Every attempt to raise the retirement age sparks mass protests. This climate is why RATP's unions focus their efforts on preserving pensions, benefits, and jobs by opposing automation and outsourcing. In Spain, the Madrid Metro follows a contract plus subsidy model similar to Paris, but at a smaller scale. It locks in its costs, operating hours, and performance standards with the regional government in advance, and they're only consistently profitable because of operating subsidies from the state. After deducting the fare revenue, the regional government covers its remaining operating costs and ensures that the agency always breaks even. If the agency wants more money, they have to negotiate that up front and accept higher service obligations in return. So even though the operating subsidy makes up a significant portion of revenue, it's still fundamentally performance-based. If the Madrid Metro exceeds the predefined targets on punctuality, reliability, cleanliness, and rider satisfaction, they earn a bonus. And if they miss targets, the government pays them less. Their profit comes from these bonuses and any cost savings. If the agency is able to deliver on its performance obligations for less than it's budgeted, it can pocket the excess. Like in Paris with the RATP, Madrid Metro can invest profit however it wants and can leverage its track record for more funding in future contracts. Because Spain isn't bound by austerity measures like France, the average Madrid Metro worker has fared better, with median annual raises of 3.1% since 2017. But to keep labor costs in check, the annual average headcount has grown just 0.4% in the same period. As generous as they are with compensation, Madrid Metro shows the same pattern as we've discussed elsewhere: more staff or higher pay, but never both. In Milan, Italy, the ATM follows almost the same script. Contracts with the city government define annual operating costs, scope of service, and performance standards years in advance. Like RATP and the Madrid Metro, ATM can't just bill the city for expenses in the middle of the year, and whatever agreed-upon operating costs that don't get covered by the fares get covered by the government in full. This model has enabled ATM to break even with an average annual operating margin of 0.3% in the past 7 years. Italy's economy resembles Japan's in terms of stagnation, and that's reflected in ATM worker compensation. Raises have been non-existent, in fact, for the past 8 years, which mirrors the overall wage stagnation in the country. ATM's workforce has only grown on average 0.9% every year over the past decade. With virtually flat wages and headcount, labor costs remain firmly in control. Unions, even with high membership, are limited to brief one-day strikes, and for essential staff, transit workers are required by law to announce their strikes weeks in advance, and they can't stage them during rush hours, so transit never fully shuts down. It's the same model in Berlin, Germany, with the rail and bus transit operator BVG. Missing targets carries real financial consequences. Last year, the city cut BVG subsidies by 9 million euros for failing to meet their established reliability benchmarks. Even so, BVG has averaged an annual operating margin of 4% over the past 8 years. The workforce has grown on average 3.5% every year in the past decade, but wages have barely moved, with a median annual increase of just 0.9%. This is partly due to Germany's long-standing austerity measures, where cities like Berlin retain low fiscal ceilings, strict budgets, and can't freely increase spending to cover wage hikes. German unions, like Japan's, favor a cooperative, dialogue-centric approach where strikes are only ever symbolic. And they all know that job security and benefits are far more realistic demands to make than wage increases. Prague shows how the contract plus subsidy model plays out in a worker-friendly market. Alongside Poland, the Czech Republic boasts the EU's lowest unemployment. Here, employers chase workers, not the other way around, and that pushes wages up as companies fight with each other to attract and hold on to their talent. As a result, Prague Metro workers have enjoyed a median annual raise of 6% in the past 13 years, the highest in Europe. The country's conservative immigration policies prevent foreign workers from filling this labor shortage, and it only strengthens the bargaining power of domestic workers. They've only ever gone on strike twice since 2008, both times blocking layoffs, outsourcing, wage cuts, and benefit reductions. So the agency's above-market raises aren't the result of some unique cultural generosity. It's simply what they need to do to keep their workforce happy. Yet the Prague Metro hasn't allowed this dynamic to drive labor costs out of control. They pay above local wage levels, issue generous annual raises, but hire very slowly. Headcount has barely grown, with an average of 0.4% per year over the past decade. Yet another example of how, even with profits, operators must choose more salaries or more staff. The evidence is clear, whether they're property plus rail or contract plus subsidy, every leading transit operator in the world runs with the same basic principles. Performance must match spend, budgets are fixed, costs must be controlled, and ROI must be proven every year, even in the labor progressive countries like France, Italy, Spain, and the Czech Republic. Only in America do transit operators get to treat budgets like suggestions, collect endless handouts with no oversight, rack up taxpayer losses to the tunes of hundreds of millions of dollars, and face no consequences with bailouts year after year. In a country dominated by cars, these agencies have grown their workforces and raised salaries every year to the point that no ridership growth, federal funding, or fare hikes could ever offset. When we rank the US leading transit agencies by their ridership, they all operate in deep blue cities. All the local and state politicians that oversee, govern, and fund these transit agencies have been democratic for decades. And since at a macro level, funding of urban mass transit has substantially grown over the same period, it's not the Republicans or carmakers. It's just a lack of common sense and accountability that the rest of the world has already figured out. The New York Metropolitan Transportation Authority is the biggest and highest profile agency in the US and serves the most riders in the nation. It's split between three separate divisions: New York City Transit, which operates the subways and buses, the Long Island Railroad, and bridges and tunnels. Because the latter were all built nearly 100 years ago and have collected tolls every day since, they're the agency's only profitable, labor-efficient, and fiscally responsible division. For the others, labor is nearly 60% of their annual operating expenses. Both NYC Transit and LIRR bleed billions of dollars every year. While in Europe, the subsidies are tied to contracts, performance targets, and oversight, there is no such accountability in New York. The MTA is like a trust fund kid. There's no mandate, requirement, or even expectation to break even. Every year, it blows past its own forecasted budget, and the state of New York picks up the tab, no matter how deep the deficit. To paper over the MTA's deficits, the state passes the cost onto New Yorkers, small businesses, motorists, and corporations in the form of tax hikes, surcharges, and fees. In essence, MTA's losses drive New York City's record cost of living. If this was Berlin, Paris, Taipei, or Tokyo, management would have been fired, subsidies would have been adjusted down, and future funds would have been withheld until a formal recovery plan was submitted to the government. But instead of being forced to improve revenue, cut costs, and achieve greater efficiencies, bailouts have become the default, not the exception, for the New York MTA. Like the Wall Street and Detroit rescues after the 2008 recession, executives and unions get saved while taxpayers are left holding the bag. When there is no consequence for incompetence and failure, it only encourages further recklessness, and that's exactly what the MTA has done. Without any hard limits and an infinite safety net, they just keep spending, and the state and city just digs around for cash, if not from Uncle Sam, then from someone else. In this light, underinvestment doesn't even qualify as an excuse. Labor is the greatest annual operating expense at nearly 60%. MTA workers work slow and inefficiently to milk their pay, as their raises are based on seniority, bonuses are awarded regardless of performance, and retirees get to cash out inflated pensions. For 23 years straight, MTA employees have averaged an astounding 6.5% annual raise, a rate that's higher than Hong Kong's famously profitable MTR and nearly double that of billion-dollar tech companies. Instead of trading off between higher pay and more staff like every other operator in the world, the MTA doesn't even pretend to try. Their workforce has grown 6% per year for the past 10 years, twice the rate of every other transit agency in the world. How is any of this possible? The answer is unions. The unions are so powerful, connected, and confrontational that they make the French look like pacifists. The unions that represent New York transit workers routinely push for above-inflation wage increases and bonuses without any consideration to the state, city, or public. They're so entrenched in New York City politics that no candidate can win without their endorsement. In return for votes, politicians quietly pledge to keep funneling public money to the transit agency, to never challenge the status quo, and to guarantee future bailouts. Even Zohran Mamdani, the Democrat socialist running for mayor, has built his campaign on the endorsements of these unions. His headline stance is to make the buses free, and the unions love it because he's promising them even more taxpayer dollars. Despite hiring 1,000 more workers a year every year for the past decade, the MTA still blows billions of dollars in overtime and somehow can't get the job done. Overtime has become a machine for personal gain, earning workers a time and a half their regular pay. Because it's rare for any business to generate enough revenue to cover 150% labor costs, overtime is tightly restricted in all industries, sectors, and organizations, public or private. But at the New York MTA and other US transit agencies, it's abused. Thanks to the unions, these workers don't just chase overtime for the pay bump, but also to pad their pensions. At the MTA, seniority, not merit, determines who gets first choice of overtime shifts. Since pensions are based on the average pay of an employee's final 3 years, many veterans deliberately pile on massive, unnecessary overtime in the run-up to retirement to inflate their benefits. There are MTA workers now collecting $200,000 a year in pensions. Pensions are designed to provide retirement security, not meant to be a lucrative windfall, and yet decades of this wage engineering has turned every worker into an ever-increasing lifetime cost that climbs until the day they die. To make matters worse, union contracts are loaded with clauses that masquerade as staff protections, but really only exist for workers to be able to extract higher pay while on the clock. While transit workers across Europe and Asia are trained to perform multiple tasks for efficiency, American unions lock transit work into rigid classifications. Every worker is limited to a narrowly defined set of tasks and trades, regardless of complexity and availability. If an electrician finds a loose bolt, they have to call in a track maintainer to tighten it, and if that person's not on site, then all work stops until they arrive. This all leads to lost productivity and double overtime. Work that could have been done in seconds by anyone can easily turn into hours of idling, and labor costs snowball while productivity shrinks. When you combine the overtime potential, seniority-based compensation, guaranteed bailouts, no performance contingencies, and absence of oversight, New York transit workers are fundamentally and economically incentivized to do nothing more than the bare minimum, as standing around pays better than finishing the job quickly. This is just the tip of the iceberg. Conductors get paid double for driving a train to a Mets game, even if it's within their normal 9-to-5. Any track work done at night or on weekends automatically pays overtime or double time, even if it's been scheduled in advance, so workers purposely avoid daytime shifts just to maximize their pay. Engineers earn double if they operate both an electric and a diesel train in the same shift, despite no real difference in skill. Maintenance crews get paid 8 hours of work every time they move a single engine in the shop, even though the task itself only takes 1 hour. The MTA was required to provide free cell phones to train drivers, but wasn't even allowed to call them, so for 8 years, these taxpayer-funded phones were just personal devices. These are some of the absurd clauses buried in the labor contracts that make cost efficiency impossible. Each division, department, and manager has the tools to fix this. They could coordinate in advance so that every trade arrives on time, batch jobs so workers can move on to backup tasks in the same area, or restructure crews to include multiple trades so that no one is just waiting around. But the apple rots from the top. This culture of complacency, abuse, and waste has been so ingrained that even the MTA's own leaders lack the urgency, incentives, or even integrity to try and change it for the better. Rather than having the department leaders self-audit, the agency dumps that responsibility onto the MTA Inspector General, a completely separate office that can investigate waste, fraud, abuse, and operational efficiencies, and pass on those recommendations, but it has no power to act. The MTA also can't fire workers without just cause, which means that building a strong enough case to terminate an employee can drag on for months or even years, which gives the unions time to shield offenders. Few workers get caught, and when they are, the unions meddle in the hearings for so long that most walk away scot-free. If you thought the labor clauses were absurd, wait until you hear these. In 2024, a station agent was caught directing tourists to pay him cash instead of buying their subway tickets on the designated machine. The worker had been employed by the MTA since 2006. Before the hearing could take place, the worker filed for retirement, which automatically closed the investigation and shielded him from any discipline. He walked away with a full pension, and the years and amounts stolen from riders and agency remain unknown. Three electricians and a repairman pooled their swipe cards so the first to arrive and the last to leave would clock in and out for everyone else. One electrician retired before the hearing, and the others received suspensions. All of these workers had been with the MTA since 1999. Cleaners pretended to work shifts and racked up hundreds of thousands of dollars in overtime when they were all actually just chilling at home. None of these cleaners or their supervisors were fired. A dispatcher was caught routinely leaving shifts early and not clocking out in order to inflate overtime pay. He had been employed since 1996. He retired before the hearing could take place. A maintenance supervisor would schedule overnight shifts at a worksite with one of his subordinates. They were filmed 5 different times leaving the job site together in a shared personal vehicle to have sex while on the clock. The supervisor was demoted and the subordinate was suspended. A back office computer worker spent 3 years double dipping as an adjunct university professor during her MTA shifts and even used her agency emails to run her classes. All she got was a 30-day suspension. A machinist pretended to be repairing subway cars when he was really at the airport fixing planes for an airline. He collected paychecks from both companies for 4 years and retired before the hearing could take place. A rail inspector disabled the GPS device on his MTA truck more than 100 times in an 8-month period and was found sleeping at home while on the clock. He retired with a full pension before the hearing took place. These are just cases from the past 2 years. The true scope of wage theft in all of these examples is unknown, as allegations are limited to the time frame in which there is evidence. These sweeping union protections all but guarantee that most abuse gets buried. If having sex with a subordinate while on the clock, secretly working another job during your shift, faking timesheets for overtime, and stealing from the company doesn't get you fired or cost you your pension, then what will? What message does this send to their coworkers and colleagues? When incompetence and unethical behavior go unpunished, it's demoralizing for anyone that's trying to make a difference. Ultimately, the unions only have one objective, which is to funnel money from the agency into their members' pockets, and they achieve it not just through these absurd labor clauses, ironclad protections, and aggressive wage demands, but also by keeping corruption buried beyond these few isolated cases. They collude to obstruct the MTA at every turn, encouraging members of one union to use swipe cards, another union to keep using manual punch cards, and a third to keep writing on paper logs so that the agency will never be able to modernize, centralize, and audit payroll under one single electronic system. And even today, they're still out there, demanding more money, better benefits, and less work for their members.
Over in the stations department, our station agents faced a very real threat from technology. The MTA now has the digital fare payment system, AMI, in every subway station. Riders can buy trips directly at the turnstile with credit cards, debit cards, and smartphones. Vice President Kelly took action to prevent our station agents from being phased out along with the MetroCard, negotiating an agreement to give agents new customer service roles and a pay raise of $1 an hour. That's more than $2,000 over the course of the year. The MTA hired nearly 300 station agents last year and plans on hiring hundreds more this year. Using a stipulation concerning bus operators with cell phone violations. Before the stipulation, bus operators faced immediate termination for a second violation. Now bus operators with at least 5 years on the job are reassigned, not fired, after a second offense. These members continue to maintain an income and health coverage for themselves and their loved ones. Local 100 is constantly focused on reducing disciplinary action and terminations imposed by management. I'm pleased to report that the number of termination cases that went through arbitration declined substantially in 2022.
New York City gets all the attention, but it's the same deal at every other leading American public transit agency. If we were to go through every transit agency, their unions, and their labor contract clauses, this episode would be another hour long. Ultimately, it's the same conundrum. Budgets are treated like suggestions, public funds flow in without any oversight, accountability, or contingencies, workers are incentivized to do only the bare minimum for pay and seniority, overtime abuse is rampant, and unions operate unchecked in power and demands. Enforcement, ethics, and efficiency are not embedded within any agency, but instead dumped onto a toothless inspector general who can only investigate a few cases a year.
The LA Metro, where fare revenue has been declining long since before COVID, somehow has the money to blow on median annual raises of 6.1% for its staff over the past 8 years.
The Chicago CTA at a median annual rate of 3.5% per year for the past 23 years. With more and more employees netting six-figure pay from five-figure bases through overtime, labor costs have only spiraled out of control, and the agency's operating losses have nearly tripled in that same time frame, from hundreds of millions to now billions. The CTA is now promising its local politicians that they'll hire more employees to cut down on this overtime, seemingly unaware that that will only deepen the hole. It's the same case with New Jersey Transit, which has given their staff 3.4% raises per year for the past 9 years, even though fare revenue has declined since 2016. Without revenue growth, losses have only magnified. The most egregious is the DC Metro, where workers have enjoyed annual raises of 7% every year for the past 23 years, outpacing even the Hong Kong MTR. Their workforce has grown 2% annually over the same period. With no attempt to even trade off between salaries and headcount, it's no surprise that DC Metro loses the most out of any transit agency in the world. Philadelphia SEPTA, San Francisco's Muni, and the Bay Area BART are all in the same boat. Unchecked spending on raises and staffing has driven all these agencies into deeper losses, and there's no revenue growth or ridership growth to turn things around. The point isn't that transit workers should never get raises, but when they're already earning a minimum 50% premium over local wages, labor costs are already elevated. When transit agencies can pile up bills without oversight, get bailed out over and over again with no consequences, and face no pressure to be fiscally responsible, the unions get to exploit this gap every time, funneling most of the taxpayer dollars into workers' pockets without delivering any cost-justifiable benefit to riders. No organization can survive with a mercenary workforce, complacent culture, parasitic factions, and toothless oversight. No business in the world could ever last when labor costs outpace both revenue and funding, and no worker can excel without pressure, accountability, and competition. Necessity is the mother of innovation, scarcity is the foundation of efficiency, and consequences are the catalyst of urgency. There's nothing in European or Asian DNA that makes them inherently better at public transit. All of these countries are poorer than the United States. The difference is ultimately cultural. Countries outside the US operate with a shared social contract and collective understanding that public transit is for the public good, and everyone must play their part to make it sustainable. Riders pay their fares. Workers don't game the system for personal enrichment. Unions, like the workers, are vested in the agency's long-term health, and the agency itself responsibly spends money to improve the overall system. But the US is a business. Without the socialism of Europe and the collectivism of Asia, that social contract just doesn't exist. Everyone comes here for money and works for money, and that mindset has carried over into public transit. From the CEOs who take home $500,000 every year, burning billions in taxpayer money, and the station janitors milking overtime in the storage closets, to the riders jumping the turnstile and the backroom politician chasing union votes, it's the pursuit of personal, immediate, individual wealth that takes precedence over everything and everyone in the U.S.